few traditions that didn't put people first. For example, we had a development department, as do all movie studios, that was charged with seeking out and developing ideas to make into films. Now I saw that this made no sense. Going forward, the development department's charter would be not to develop scripts, but to hire good people, figure out what they needed, assign them to projects that matched their skills, and make sure they functioned well together. To this day, we keep adjusting and fiddling with this model, but the underlying goals remain the same. Find, develop, and support good people, and they in turn will find, develop, and own good ideas. In a sense, this was related to my thinking about W. Edward Deming's work in Japan. Though Pixar didn't rely on a traditional assembly line, that is, with conveyor belts connecting each workstation, the making of a film happened in order, with each team passing the product or idea off to the next, who pushed it further down the line. To ensure quality, I believed, any person on any team needed to be able to identify a problem and, in effect, pull the cord to stop the line. To create a culture in which this was possible, you needed more than a cord within easy reach. You needed to show your people that you meant it when you said that while efficiency was a goal, quality was the goal. More and more, I saw that by putting people first, not just saying that we did, but proving that we did by the actions we took, we were protecting that culture. On the most basic level, Toy Story 2 was a wake-up call. Going forward, the needs of a movie could never again outweigh the needs of our people. We needed to do more to keep them healthy. As soon as we wrapped the film, we set about addressing the needs of our injured, stressed-out employees and coming up with strategies to prevent future deadline pressures from hurting our workers again. These strategies went beyond ergonomically designed workstations, yoga classes, and physical therapy. Toy Story 2 was a case study in how something that is usually considered a plus, a motivated, workaholic workforce pulling together to make a deadline, could destroy itself if left unchecked. Though I was immensely proud of what we had accomplished, I vowed that we would never make a film that way again. It was management's job to take the long view, to intervene and protect our people from their willingness to pursue excellence at all costs. Not to do so would be irresponsible. This is trickier than you might think. As a group, Pixar's people take pride in their work. They're ambitious, high achievers who want to do their best and then some. On the management side, we want the next product to be better than the last, while at the same time we need to meet budget and schedule requirements. Inspiring managers push their people to excel. That's what we expect them to do. But when the powerful forces that create this positive dynamic turn negative, they are hard to counteract. It's a fine line. On any film, there are inevitable periods of extreme crunch and stress, some of which can be healthy if they don't go on too long. But the ambitions of both managers and their teams can exacerbate each other and become unhealthy. It is a leader's responsibility to see this and guide it, not exploit it. If we are in this for the long haul, we have to take care of ourselves, support healthy habits, and encourage our employees to have fulfilling lives outside of work. Moreover, everyone's home lives change as they, and their children if they have them, age. This means creating a culture in which maternity or paternity leave is not seen as an impediment to career advancement. That may not sound revolutionary, but at many companies, parents know that taking that leave comes at a cost. A truly committed employee, they are wordlessly told, wants to be at work. That's not true at Pixar. Supporting your employees means encouraging them to strike a balance not merely by saying, be balanced, but also by making it easier for them to achieve balance. Having a swimming pool, a volleyball court, and a soccer field on site tells our workers that we value exercise and a life beyond the desk. But leadership also means paying close attention to ever-changing dynamics in the workplace. For example, when our younger employees, those without families, work longer hours than those who are parents, we must be mindful not to compare the output of these two groups without being mindful of the context. I'm not talking just about the health of our employees here. I'm talking about their long-term productivity and happiness. Investing in this stuff pays dividends down the line. I know of one gaming company in Los Angeles that had a stated goal of turning over 15% of its workforce every year. The reasoning behind such a policy was that productivity shoots up when you hire smart, hungry kids fresh out of school and work them to death. Attrition was inevitable under such conditions, but that was okay, because the company's needs outweighed those of the worker. Did it work? Sure, maybe. To a point. But if you ask me, that kind of thinking is not just misguided, it is immoral. At Pixar, I have made it known that we must always have the flexibility to recognize and support the need for balance in all of our employees' lives. While all of us believed in that principle and had from the beginning, Toy Story 2 helped me see how those beliefs could get pushed aside in the face of immediate pressures. I began this chapter by talking about two phrases that, to my mind, both helped us and deluded us in the early days of Pixar. Coming out of Toy Story, we thought that story is king and trust the process were core principles that would carry us forward and keep us focused, that the phrases themselves had the power to help us do better work. It's not just Pixar people who believe this, by the way. Try it yourself. Say to somebody in the creative world that story is king, and they will nod their heads vigorously. Of course, it just rings true. Everyone knows how important a well-wrought, emotionally affecting storyline is to any movie. Story is king differentiated us, we thought, not just because we said it, but also because we believed it and acted accordingly. As I talked to more people in the industry and learned more about other studios, however, I found that everyone repeated some version of this mantra. It didn't matter whether they were making a genuine work of art or complete dreck. They all said that story is the most important thing. This was a reminder of something that sounds obvious, but isn't. Merely repeating ideas means nothing. You must act and think accordingly. Parroting the phrase "story is king" at Pixar didn't help the inexperienced directors on Toy Story 2 one bit. What I'm saying is that this guiding principle, while simply stated and easily repeated, didn't protect us from things going wrong. In fact, it gave us false assurance that things would be okay. Likewise, we trusted the process, but the process didn't save Toy Story 2 either. Trust the process had morphed into assume that the process will fix things for us. It gave us solace, which we felt we needed, but it also coaxed us into letting down our guard and in the end made us passive. Even worse, it made us sloppy. Once this became clear to me, I began telling people that the phrase was meaningless. I told our staff that it had become a crutch that was distracting us from engaging in a meaningful way with our problems. We should trust in people, I told them, not processes. The error we'd made was forgetting that the process has no agenda and doesn't have taste. It is just a tool, a framework. We needed to take more responsibility and ownership of our own work, our need for self-discipline, and our goals. Imagine an old heavy suitcase whose well-worn handles are hanging by a few threads. The handle is trust the process, or story is king, a pithy statement that seems, on the face of it, to stand for so much more. The suitcase represents all that has gone into the formation of the phrase, the experience, the deep wisdom, the truths that emerge from struggle. Too often we grab the handle and, without realizing it, walk off without the suitcase. What's more, we don't even think about what we've left behind. After all, the handle is so much easier to carry around than the suitcase. Once you're aware of the suitcase handle problem, you'll see it everywhere. People glom onto words and stories that are often just stand-ins for real action and meaning. Advertisers look for words that imply a product's value and use that as a substitute for value itself. Companies constantly tell us about their commitment to excellence, implying that this means they will make only top-shelf products. Words like quality and excellence are misapplied so relentlessly that they border on meaningless. Managers scour books and magazines looking for greater understanding, but settle instead for adopting a new terminology, thinking that using fresh words will bring them closer to their goals. When someone comes up with a phrase that sticks, it becomes a meme, which migrates around even as it disconnects from its original meaning. To ensure quality, then, excellence must be an earned word, attributed by others to us, not proclaimed by us about ourselves. It is the responsibility of good leaders to make sure that words remain attached to the meanings and ideals they represent. I should say here that even as I rail against trust the process as a flawed motivational tool, I still understand the need for faith in a creative context. Because we are often working to invent something that doesn't yet exist, it can be scary to come to work. Early on in the production of a film, chaos reigns. The bulk of what the directors and their teams are doing is not cohering, and the responsibilities, pressures, and expectations are intense. How, then, do you move forward when so little is visible and so much is unknown? I have seen directors and writers who were stuck and could not get unstuck because they couldn't see where to go next. It is here that some of my colleagues have insisted that I am wrong, that trust the process has meaning. They see it as code for keep on going even when things look bleak. When we trust the process, they argue, we can relax, let go, take a flyer on something radical. We can accept that any given idea may not work and yet minimize our fear of failure because we believe we will get there in the end. When we trust the process, we remember that we are resilient, that we've experienced discouragement before only to come out the other side. When we trust the process, or perhaps more accurately, when we trust the people who use the process, we are optimistic but also realistic. The trust comes from knowing that we are safe, that our colleagues will not judge us for failures, but will encourage us to keep pushing the boundaries. But to me, the key is not to let this trust, our faith, lull us into the abdication of personal responsibility. When that happens, we fall into dull repetition, producing empty versions of what was made before. As Brad Bird, who joined Pixar as a director in 2000, likes to say, "The process either makes you or unmakes you." I like Brad's way of looking at it because while it gives the process power, it implies that we have an active role to play in it as well. Catherine Serafian, a producer who's been at Pixar since Toy Story, tells me she prefers to envision triggering the process over trusting it. Observing it to see where it's faltering, then slapping it around a bit to make sure it's awake. Again, the individual plays the active role, not the process itself. Or, to put it another way, it is up to the individual to remember that it's okay to use the handle, just as long as you don't forget the suitcase. At Pixar, Toy Story 2 taught us this lesson, that we must always be alert to shifting dynamics because our future depends on it, once and for all. Begun as a direct-to-video sequel, the project proved not only that it was important to everyone that we weren't tolerating second-class films, but also that everything we did, everything associated with our name, needed to be good. Thinking this way was not just about morale. It was a signal to everyone at Pixar that they were part owners of the company's greatest asset, its quality. Around this time, John coined a new phrase, "Quality is the best business plan." What he meant was that quality is not a consequence of following some set of behaviors. Rather, it is a prerequisite and a mindset you must have before you decide what you are setting out to do. Everyone says quality is important, but they must do more than say it. They must live, think, and breathe it. When our people asserted that they only wanted to make films of the highest quality, and when we pushed ourselves to the limit in order to prove our commitment to that ideal, Pixar's identity was cemented. We would be a company that would never settle. That didn't mean that we wouldn't make mistakes. Mistakes are part of creativity. But when we did, we would strive to face them without defensiveness and with a willingness to change. Struggling through the production of Toy Story 2 twisted our heads around, causing us to look inward, to be self-critical, and to change the way we thought about ourselves. When I say this was the defining moment for Pixar, I mean it in the most dynamic sense. Our need for and embrace of introspection was just beginning. In the next section of the book, I want to explore how that introspection developed. The chapters revolve around the questions we would soon be tackling as a company. What is the nature of honesty? If everyone agrees about its importance, why do we find it hard to be frank? How do we think about our own failures and fears? Is there a way to make our managers more comfortable with unexpected results, the inevitable surprises that arise no matter how well you've planned? How can we address the imperative many managers feel to over-control the process? With what we have learned so far, can we finally get the process right? Where are we still deluded? These questions would continue to challenge us for years to come, indeed, even to this day. Part 2. Protecting the New. Chapter 5. Honesty and Candor. Ask anyone, should people be honest, and of course their answer will be yes. It has to be. Saying no is to endorse dishonesty, which is like coming out against literacy or childhood nutrition. It sounds like a moral transgression. But the fact is, there are often good reasons not to be honest. When it comes to interacting with other people in a work environment, there are times when we choose not to say what we really think. This creates a dilemma. On one level, the only way to get a grip on the facts, issues, and nuances we need to solve problems and collaborate effectively is by communicating fully and openly, by not withholding or misleading. There is no doubt that our decision-making is better if we are able to draw on the collective knowledge and unvarnished opinions of the group. But as valuable as the information is that comes from honesty, and as loudly as we proclaim its importance, our own fears and instincts for self-preservation often cause us to hold back. To address this reality, we need to free ourselves of honesty's baggage. One way to do that is to replace the word honesty with another word that has a similar meaning, but fewer moral connotations. Candor. Candor is forthrightness or frankness, not so different from honesty, really. And yet, in common usage, the word communicates not just truth-telling, but a lack of reserve. Everyone knows that sometimes being reserved is healthy, even necessary for survival. Nobody thinks that being less than candid makes you a bad person, while no one wants to be called dishonest. People have an easier time talking about their level of candor because they don't think they will be punished for admitting that they sometimes hold their tongues. This is essential. You cannot address the obstacles to candor until people feel free to say that they exist, and using the word honesty only makes it harder to talk about those barriers. Of course, there are sometimes legitimate reasons not to be candid. Politicians, for example, can pay a steep price for speaking too bluntly about contentious issues. CEOs can get dinged for being too open with the press or with shareholders, and they certainly don't want competitors to know their plans. I will be less than candid at work if it means not embarrassing or offending someone, or in any number of situations where choosing my words carefully feels like the smart strategy. But that's not to say lack of candor should be celebrated. A hallmark of a healthy creative culture is that its people feel free to share ideas, opinions, and criticisms. Lack of candor, if unchecked, ultimately leads to dysfunctional environments. So how can a manager ensure that his or her working group, department, or company is embracing candor? I look for ways to institutionalize it by putting mechanisms in place that explicitly say it is valuable. In this chapter, we will look into the workings of one of Pixar's key mechanisms, the brain trust, which we rely upon to push us toward excellence and to root out mediocrity. The brain trust, which meets every few months or so to assess each movie we're making, is our primary delivery system for straight talk. Its premise is simple. Put smart, passionate people in a room together, charge them with identifying and solving problems, and encourage them to be candid with one another. People who would feel obligated to be honest somehow feel freer when asked for their candor. They have a choice about whether to give it, and thus, when they do give it, it tends to be genuine. The brain trust is one of the most important traditions at Pixar. It's not foolproof. Sometimes its interactions only serve to highlight the difficulties of achieving candor. But when we get it right, the results are phenomenal. The brain trust sets the tone for everything we do. In many ways, it is no different than any other group of creative people. Within it, you will find humility and ego, openness and generosity. It varies in size and purpose, depending on what it has been called upon to examine. But always, its most essential element is candor. This isn't just some pie-in-the-sky idea. Without the critical ingredient that is candor, there can be no trust. And without trust, creative collaboration is not possible. Over the years, as the brain trust has evolved, the dynamics within the group have evolved along with it, and this has required continual attention on our part. While I attend and participate in almost all brain trust meetings and enjoy discussing the storytelling, I see my primary role, and that of my colleague Jim Morris, who is Pixar's general manager, as making sure that the compact upon which the meetings are based is protected and upheld. This part of our job is never done because, as it turns out, you can't address or eliminate the blocks to candor once and for all. The fear of saying something stupid and looking bad, of offending someone or being intimidated, of retaliating or being retaliated against, they all have a way of reasserting themselves, even once you think they've been vanquished. And when they do, you must address them squarely. There is some dispute about when exactly the brain trust came into being. That's because it developed organically, growing out of the rare working relationship among the five men who led and edited the production of Toy Story: John Lasseter, Andrew Stanton, Pete Docter, Lee Unkrich, and Joe Ranft. From Pixar's earliest days, this quintet gave us a solid example of what a highly functional working group should be. They were funny, focused, smart, and relentlessly candid with each other. Most crucially, they never allowed themselves to be thwarted by the kinds of structural or personal issues that can render meaningful communication in a group setting impossible. It was only when we rallied to fix Toy Story 2, coming together to solve a crisis, that the brain trust entered the Pixar lexicon as an official term. Over those 9 months in 1999, when we were rushing to reboot this broken film, the brain trust would evolve into an enormously beneficial and efficient entity. Even in its earliest meetings, I was struck by how constructive the feedback was. Each of the participants focused on the film at hand and not on some hidden personal agenda. They argued, sometimes heatedly, but always about the project. They were not motivated by the kinds of things, getting credit for an idea, pleasing their supervisors, winning a point just to say you did, that too often lurk beneath the surface of work-related interactions. The members saw each other as peers. The passion expressed in a brain trust meeting was never taken personally because everyone knew it was directed at solving problems. And largely because of that trust and mutual respect, its problem-solving powers were immense. After the release of Toy Story 2, our production slate expanded rapidly. Suddenly, we had several projects going at once, which meant that we couldn't have the same five people working exclusively on every film. We were not a little startup anymore. Pete was off working on Monsters, Inc. Andrew had started Finding Nemo, and Brad Bird had joined us to begin work on The Incredibles. The Brain Trust had to evolve then from a tight, well-defined group that worked on one film together until it was done, to a larger, more fluid group that assembled as needed to solve problems on all our films. While we still called it the Brain Trust, there was no hard and fast membership list. Over the years, its ranks have grown to include a variety of people, directors, writers, and heads of story, whose only requirement is that they display a knack for storytelling. Among those talented additions, Mary Coleman, the head of Pixar's story department, development executives Kiel Murray and Karen Paik, and writers Michael Arndt, Meg Lefauve, and Victoria Strauss. The one thing that has never changed is the demand for candor, which, while its value seems obvious, is harder to achieve than one might think. Let's imagine that you just joined a brain trust meeting for the first time and sat down in a room full of smart and experienced people to discuss a film that has just been screened. There are many good reasons to be careful about what you say, right? You want to be polite, you want to respect or defer to others, and you don't want to embarrass yourself or come off as having all the answers. Before you speak up, no matter how self-assured you are, you will check yourself. Is this a good idea or a stupid one? How many times am I allowed to say something stupid before others begin to doubt me? Can I tell the director that his protagonist is unlikable or that his second act is incomprehensible? It's not that you want to be dishonest or to withhold from others. At this stage, you aren't even thinking about candor. You're thinking about not looking like an idiot. Compounding matters is the fact that you aren't the only one who's struggling with these doubts. Everyone is. Societal conditioning discourages telling the truth to those perceived to be in higher positions. Then there's human nature. The more people there are in the room, the more pressure there is to perform well. Strong and confident people can intimidate their colleagues, subconsciously signaling that they aren't interested in negative feedback or criticism that challenges their thinking. When the stakes are high and there is a sense that people in the room don't understand a director's project, it can feel to that director like everything they've worked so hard on is in jeopardy, under attack. Their brains go into overdrive, reading all of the subtexts and fighting off the perceived threats to what they've built. When so much is on the line, the barriers to truly candid discussions are formidable. And yet, candor could not be more crucial to our creative process. Why? Because early on, all of our movies suck. That's a blunt assessment, I know, but I make a point of repeating it often, and I choose that phrasing because saying it in a softer way fails to convey how bad the first versions of our films really are. I'm not trying to be modest or self-effacing by saying this. Pixar films are not good at first, and our job is to make them so, to go, as I say, from suck to not suck. This idea that all the movies we now think of as brilliant were at one time terrible is a hard concept for many to grasp. But think about how easy it would be for a movie about talking toys to feel derivative, sappy, or overtly merchandise-driven. Think about how off-putting a movie about rats preparing food could be, or how risky it must have seemed to start WALL-E with 39 dialogue-free minutes. We dare to attempt these stories, but we don't get them right on the first pass. And this is as it should be. Creativity has to start somewhere, and we are true believers in the power of bracing candid feedback in the iterative process, reworking, reworking, and reworking again until a flawed story finds its through line or a hollow character finds its soul. As I've discussed, first we draw storyboards of the script and then edit them together with temporary voices and music to make a crude mock-up of the film known as reels. Then the brain trust watches this version of the movie and discusses what's not ringing true, what could be better, what's not working at all. Notably, they do not prescribe how to fix the problems they diagnose. They test weak points, they make suggestions, but it is up to the director to settle on a path forward. A new version of the movie is generated every 3 to 6 months, and the process repeats itself. It takes about 12,000 storyboard drawings to make one 90-minute reel, and because of the iterative nature of the process I'm describing, story teams commonly create 10 times that number by the time their work is done. In general, the movie steadily improves with each iteration, although sometimes a director becomes stuck, unable to address the feedback he or she is being given. Luckily, another brain trust meeting is usually around the corner. To understand what the brain trust does and why it is so central to Pixar, you have to start with a basic truth. People who take on complicated creative projects become lost at some point in the process. It is the nature of things. In order to create, you must internalize and almost become the project for a while. And that near fusing with the project is an essential part of its emergence. But it is also confusing. Where once a movie's writer-director had perspective, he or she loses it. Where once he or she could see a forest, now there are only trees. The details converge to obscure the whole, and that makes it difficult to move forward substantially in any one direction. The experience can be overwhelming. All directors, no matter how talented, organized, or clear of vision, become lost somewhere along the way. That creates a problem for those who seek to give helpful feedback. How do you get a director to address a problem he or she cannot see? The answer depends, of course, on the situation. The director may be right about the potential impact of his central idea, but maybe he simply hasn't set it up well enough for the brain trust to understand that. Maybe he doesn't realize that much of what he thinks is visible on screen is, in fact, only visible in his own head. Or maybe the ideas presented in the reels don't work and won't ever work, and the only path forward is to blow something up or start over. No matter what, the process of coming to clarity takes patience and candor. In Hollywood, studio executives typically communicate their criticisms of an early cut of a film by giving extensive notes to the director. The movie will be screened and suggestions will be typed up and delivered a few days later. The problem is, directors don't want the notes because they are usually coming from people who aren't filmmakers and are seen as ignorant and interfering. There is a built-in tension, then, between directors and the studios that employ them. To put it in stark terms, the studios are paying the bills and want the films to be commercially successful, while the directors want to preserve their artistic vision. I should add that some notes offered by studio executives are quite astute. People outside of the production can often see more clearly. But when you add oft-held resentments about input from non-creative people to how difficult it is to be a director in the first place, presiding over a project that, as I've said, sucks for months before it gets good, this tension makes it difficult to bridge the divide between art and commerce. Which is why we don't give notes this way at Pixar. We've developed our own model based on our determination to be a filmmaker-led studio. That does not mean there is no hierarchy here. It means that we try to create an environment where people want to hear each other's notes, even when those notes are challenging, and where everyone has a vested interest in one another's success. We give our filmmakers both freedom and responsibility. For example, we believe that the most promising stories are not assigned to filmmakers, but emerge from within them. With few exceptions, our directors make movies that they have conceived of and are burning to make. Then, because we know that this passion will at some point blind them to their movie's inevitable problems, we offer them the counsel of the Brain Trust. You may be thinking, how is the Brain Trust different from any other feedback mechanism? There are two key differences as I see it. The first is that the Brain Trust is made up of people with a deep understanding of storytelling and usually people who have been through the process themselves. While the directors welcome critiques from many sources along the way, and in fact, when our films are screened in-house, all Pixar employees are asked to send notes. They particularly prize feedback from fellow directors and storytellers. The second difference is that the Brain Trust has no authority. This is crucial. The director does not have to follow any of the specific suggestions given. After a Brain Trust meeting, it is up to him or her to figure out how to address the feedback. Brain Trust meetings are not top-down do-this-or-else affairs. By removing from the Brain Trust the power to mandate solutions, we affect the dynamics of the group in ways I believe are essential. While problems in a film are fairly easy to identify, the sources of those problems are often extraordinarily difficult to assess. A mystifying plot twist or a less-than-credible change of heart in our main character is often caused by subtle underlying issues elsewhere in the story. Think of it like a patient complaining of knee pain that stems from his fallen arches. If you operated on the knee, it wouldn't just fail to alleviate the pain. It could easily compound it. To alleviate the pain, you have to identify and deal with the root of the problem. The Brain Trust's notes, then, are intended to bring the true causes of problems to the surface, not to demand a specific remedy. Moreover, we don't want the Brain Trust to solve a director's problem because we believe that, in all likelihood, our solution won't be as good as the one the director and his or her creative team comes up with. We believe that ideas, and thus films, only become great when they are challenged and tested. In academia, peer review is the process by which professors are evaluated by others in their field. I like to think of the Brain Trust as Pixar's version of peer review, a forum that ensures we raise our game, not by being prescriptive, but by offering candor and deep analysis. That doesn't mean it doesn't get tough sometimes. Naturally, every director would prefer to be told that his film is a masterpiece. But because of the way the brain trust is structured, the pain of being told that flaws are apparent or revisions are needed is minimized. Rarely does a director get defensive because no one is pulling rank or telling the filmmaker what to do. The film itself, not the filmmaker, is under the microscope. This principle eludes most people, but it is critical. You are not your idea, and if you identify too closely with your ideas, you will take offense when they are challenged. To set up a healthy feedback system, you must remove power dynamics from the equation. You must enable yourself, in other words, to focus on the problem, not the person. Here's how it works. On an appointed morning, the Brain Trust gathers for a screening of the film in progress. After the screening, we head for a conference room, have some lunch, gather our thoughts, and sit down to talk. The director and producer of the film give a summary of where they think they are. We've locked down the first act, but we know the second act is still gelling, they'll say, or the ending still isn't connecting like we want it to. Then the feedback usually begins with John. While everyone has an equal voice in a brain trust meeting, John sets the tone, calling out the sequences he liked best, identifying some themes and ideas he thinks need to be improved. That's all it takes to launch the back and forth. Everybody jumps in with observations about the film's strengths and weaknesses. Before we get to the forces that shape that discussion, let's take a moment to look at things from the filmmaker's point of view. 201, they regard these sessions as essential. Michael Arndt, who wrote Toy Story 3, says he thinks to make a great film, its makers must pivot at some point from creating the story for themselves to creating it for others. To him, the brain trust provides that pivot, and it is necessarily painful. Part of the suffering involves giving up control, he says. I can think it's the funniest joke in the world, but if nobody in that room laughs, I have to take it out. It hurts that they can see something you can't. Rich Moore, whose first animated feature for Disney was Wreck-It Ralph, likens the brain trust to a bunch of people who are each working on their own puzzles. Since John and I took over at Disney Animation, that studio has adopted this tradition of candor as well. Somehow, and perhaps especially because they have less invested, a director who's struggling with his own dilemmas can see another director's struggles more clearly than his own. It's like I can put my crossword puzzle away and help you with your Rubik's Cube a little bit, is how he puts it. Bob Peterson, a member of the Brain Trust who has helped write and provide voices for 11 Pixar films, uses another analogy to describe the Brain Trust. He calls it the Grand Eye of Sauron, a reference to the lidless, all-seeing character in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, because when it focuses on you, there's no avoiding its gaze. But the brain trust is benevolent. It wants to help, and it has no selfish agenda. Andrew Stanton, who has been on the giving or the receiving end of almost every brain trust meeting we've ever had, likes to say that if Pixar is a hospital and the movies are the patients, then the brain trust is made up of trusted doctors. In this analogy, it's important to remember that the movie's director and producer are doctors, too. It's as if they've gathered a panel of consulting experts to help find an accurate diagnosis for an extremely confounding case. But ultimately, it's the filmmakers and no one else who will make the final decision about the wisest course of treatment. Jonas Rivera, who started as an office assistant on Toy Story and has gone on to produce two films for us, alters Andrew's hospital analogy slightly, adding this. If the movies are patients, then they are in utero when the brain trust first evaluates them. The brain trust meetings, he says, are where the movie is born. To get a clearer sense of how candor is delivered at Pixar, I want to take you inside a brain trust meeting. This one followed an early screening of a Pete Docter film, then known as the untitled Pixar movie that takes you inside the mind. The premise for the film had emerged straight out of Pete's cranium, and it was predictably ambitious, layered, and complex. Already, Pete and his team had spent months hashing out whose mind exactly he was going to take viewers inside of, and what those viewers would ultimately find when they got there. As brain trusts go, this was a crowded one, with about 20 people at the table and 15 more in chairs against the walls. Everyone grabbed plates of food on the way in and, after a little small talk, got down to business. Earlier, before the screening, Pete had described what they'd come up with so far in terms of the overall conceit of the film and the specific story points that he hoped would connect with the audience. "What's inside the mind?" he asked his colleagues. "Your emotions. And we've worked really hard to make these characters look the way those emotions feel. We have our main character, an emotion called joy, who is effervescent. She literally glows when she's excited. Then we have fear. He thinks of himself as confident and suave, but he's a little raw nerve and tends to freak out. The other characters are anger, sadness, her shape is inspired by teardrops, and disgust, who basically turns up her nose at everything. And all these guys work at what we call headquarters." That got a laugh, as did many scenes in the roughed-out 10-minute preview that followed, which everyone agreed had the potential to be, like Pete's previous film, Up, among our most original and affecting. As I've said, Pete is superb at teasing out subtle moments that are both funny and emotionally authentic, and this idea of bringing a person's competing emotions to life was inspired, rich with possibility. But as the brain trust came to life, there seemed to be a consensus that one of the movie's major scenes, an argument between two characters about why certain memories fade while others burn bright forever, was too minor to sufficiently connect audiences to the profound ideas the film was attempting to tackle. Pete is a big guy, 6'4", but despite his size, he projects an undaunted gentleness. This was in evidence in the conference room now as he listened to us parse what was amiss in this pivotal scene. His face was open, not pained. He'd been through this many times before, and he believed in its power to help him get where he was trying to go. Midway down the table, Brad Bird shifted in his chair. Brad joined Pixar in 2000 after having written and directed The Iron Giant at Warner Brothers, and his first movie for us was The Incredibles, which opened in 2004. Brad is a born rebel who fights against creative conformity in any guise. The smell of artistic victory is his drug, and with his rapid, high-energy delivery, he will turn almost everything into a battle to win for the cause of creativity, even if there isn't anybody around to fight. So it was no surprise that he was among the first to articulate his worries about the core of the story feeling too slight. "I understand that you want to keep this simple and relatable," he told Pete, "but I think we need something that your audience can get a little more invested in." Andrew Stanton spoke next. Andrew was fond of saying that people need to be wrong as fast as they can. In a battle, if you're faced with two hills and you're unsure which one to attack, he says, the right course of action is to hurry up and choose. If you find out it's the wrong hill, turn around and attack the other one. In that scenario, the only unacceptable course of action is running between the hills. Now he seemed to be suggesting that Pete and his team had stormed the wrong hill. "I think you need to spend more time settling on the rules of your imagined world," he said. Every Pixar movie has its own rules that viewers have to accept, understand, and enjoy understanding. The voices of the toys in the Toy Story films, for example, are never audible to humans. The rats in Ratatouille walk on four paws like normal vermin, except for Remy, our star, whose upright posture sets him apart. In Pete's film, one of the rules, at least at this point, was that memories depicted as glowing glass globes were stored in the brain by traveling through a maze of chutes into a kind of archive. When retrieved or remembered, they'd roll back down another tangle of chutes like bowling balls being returned to bowlers at the alley. That particular construct was elegant and effective, but Andrew suggested that another rule needed to be firmed up and clarified. How memories and emotions change over time as the brain gets older. This was the moment in the film, Andrew said, to establish some key themes. Listening to this, I remembered how in Toy Story 2, the addition of Wheezy immediately helped establish the idea that damaged toys could be discarded, left to sit, unloved, on the shelf. Andrew felt there was a similarly impactful opportunity here that was being missed, and thus was keeping the film from working, and he said so candidly. "Pete, this movie is about the inevitability of change," he said, "and of growing up." This set Brad off. "A lot of us in this room have not grown up, and I mean that in the best way," he said. "The conundrum is how to become mature, how to take on responsibility and become reliable while at the same time preserving your childlike wonder. People have come up to me many times, as I'm sure has happened to many people in this room, and said, 'Gee, I wish I could be creative like you. That would be something to be able to draw.' But I believe that everyone begins with the ability to draw. Kids are instinctively there, but a lot of them unlearn it, or people tell them they can't or it's impractical. So yes, kids have to grow up, but maybe there's a way to suggest that they could be better off if they held on to some of their childish ideas. Pete, the thing I want to give you a huge round of applause for is, this is a frickin' big idea to try to make a movie about," Brad continued, his voice full of affection. "I've said to you on previous films, you're trying to do a triple backflip into a gale force wind, and you're mad at yourself for not sticking the landing. Like it's amazing you're alive. What you're doing with this film is the same, and it's the kind of thing that nobody else in the movie industry is doing with a sizable budget, so huge round of applause." Brad paused as everyone clapped, then he grinned at Pete, who grinned back. "And you're in for a world of hurt," Brad said. An important corollary to the assertion that the brain trust must be candid is that filmmakers must be ready to hear the truth. Candor is only valuable if the person on the receiving end is open to it and willing, if necessary, to let go of things that don't work. Jonas Rivera, the producer of Pete's film, tries to make that painful process easier by doing something he calls headlining the main points of a brain trust session for whichever director he's assisting, distilling the many observations down to a digestible takeaway. Once this brain trust meeting wrapped up, this is exactly what he did for Pete, ticking off the areas that seemed the most problematic, reminding him of the scenes that resonated most. "So what do we blow up?" Jonas asked. "What do we go backwards on? And what do you love? Is what you loved about the film different now than it was when we started?" "The way the movie opens," Pete responded, "I love." Jonas raised his hand in a salute. "Okay, that's the movie then," he said. "How we set up the story has to handshake with that." "I agree," Pete said. They were on their way. Frank talk, spirited debate, laughter, and love. If I could distill a brain trust meeting down to its most essential ingredients, those four things would surely be among them. But newcomers often notice something else first. The volume. Routinely, brain trust attendees become so energized and excited that they talk over each other and voices tend to rise. I'll admit that there have been times when outsiders think they've witnessed a heated argument or even some kind of intervention. They haven't, though I understand their confusion, which stems from their inability, after such a brief visit, to grasp the brain trust's intent. A lively debate in a brain trust meeting is not being waged in the hopes of any one person winning the day. To the extent there is argument, it seeks only to excavate the truth. That is part of the reason why Steve Jobs didn't come to brain trust meetings at Pixar, a mutually agreed prohibition based on my belief that his bigger-than-life presence would make it harder to be candid. We had reached this agreement way back in 1993, on a day that I happened to be visiting Microsoft, and Steve reached me by phone, worried that I was being wooed to take a job there. I had no intention of working at Microsoft, and it wasn't why I was there, but I knew he was nervous, and I took the opportunity to exert some leverage. "This group works well together," I told him of the Brain Trust. "But if you go to its meetings, it will change what they are." He agreed, and believing that John and the story people knew more about narrative than he did, he left it to them. At Apple, he had the reputation for being deeply involved in the most minute detail of every product, but at Pixar, he didn't believe that his instincts were better than the people here, so he stayed out. That's how much candor matters at Pixar. It overrides hierarchy. Brain trust meetings require giving candid notes, but they do a great deal more than that. The most productive creative sessions allow for the exploration of myriad trains of thought. Take WALL-E, for example, which was known early on as Trash Planet. For a long time, that movie ended with our googly-eyed trash compactor robot saving his beloved droid Eve from destruction in a dumpster. But there was something about that ending that nagged, that never quite felt right. We had countless discussions about it, but Andrew Stanton, the director, was having difficulty putting his finger on what was wrong, let alone finding a solution. The confusing thing was that the romantic plotline seemed right. Of course WALL-E would save Eve. He'd fallen in love with her the moment he saw her. In a sense, that was precisely the flaw. And it was Brad Bird who pointed that out to Andrew in a brain trust meeting. "You've denied your audience the moment they've been waiting for," he said. "The moment where Eve throws away all her programming and goes all out to save WALL-E. Give it to them. The audience wants it." As soon as Brad said that, it was like, bing! After the meeting, Andrew went off and wrote an entirely new ending in which Eve saves WALL-E, and at the next screening there wasn't a dry eye in the house. Michael Arndt remembers it was Andrew, meanwhile, who gave a brain trust note on Toy Story 3 that fundamentally altered the end of that movie's second act. At that point in the film, Lotso, the pink teddy bear and mean-spirited leader of the daycare center toys, is overthrown after the toys' mutiny. But the problem was the mutiny wasn't believable because the impetus behind it didn't ring true. "In that draft," Michael told me, "I had Woody giving this big heroic speech about what a mean guy Lotso was, and it changed everyone's mind about Lotso. But in the brain trust, Andrew said, 'Nope, I don't buy it. These toys aren't stupid. They know Lotso isn't a good guy. They've only aligned themselves with him because he's the most powerful.' This sparked a pitched discussion in the room until finally Michael hit on an analogy. If you think of Lotso as Stalin and the other toys as his cowering subjects, then Big Baby, the bald-headed doll with one droopy eye who acts as Lotso's enforcer, was Stalin's army." At that point, a fix began to emerge at last. "If you flip the army, then you can get rid of Stalin," Michael said. So the question was, what can Woody do that will turn Big Baby's sympathies against Lotso? That was the problem I faced. The solution, a reveal of a previously unknown injustice, that Lotso's duplicity had led Big Baby to be abandoned by his little girl owner, was all Michael's, but he never would have found it if not for the brain trust. It is natural for people to fear that such an inherently critical environment will feel threatening and unpleasant, like a trip to the dentist. The key is to look at the viewpoints being offered in any successful feedback group as additive, not competitive. A competitive approach measures other ideas against your own, turning the discussion into a debate to be won or lost. An additive approach, on the other hand, starts with the understanding that each participant contributes something, even if it's only an idea that fuels the discussion and ultimately doesn't work. The brain trust is valuable because it broadens your perspective, allowing you to peer, at least briefly, through others' eyes. Brad Bird has a terrific example of exactly this. An instance when the brain trust helped him fix something he didn't realize was a problem. It was during production on The Incredibles when people raised concerns about a scene in which Helen and Bob Parr, a.k.a. Elastigirl and Mr. Incredible, are having an argument. Many people in the brain trust thought the scene in which Bob is caught sneaking into his house late one night after doing a little superhero moonlighting felt all wrong. What Brad likes best about this example is that the brain trust helped him find a solution even though it failed to diagnose what was truly amiss. The fix that was suggested in the brain trust session wasn't the right one, and yet Brad says that it helped him immensely. Sometimes the brain trust will know something's wrong, but they will identify the wrong symptom, he told me. I knew what the film's tone was. I had pitched the tone, and everybody bought the tone that was pitched. But this was one of the first scenes that the brain trust was seeing illustrated with voices. And I think they were privately thinking, are we doing a Bergman film? Bob was yelling at Helen, and the note I got was, God, it seems like he's bullying her. I really don't like him. You've got to rewrite it. So I go in to rewrite it, and I look at it and think, no, that is what he would say, and that is how she would respond. I don't want to change a damn thing, but I know I can't say that because something's not working. And then I realize the problem. Physically, Bob is the size of a house, and Helen is this little tiny thing. Even though Helen is his equal, what you're seeing on the screen is this big, threatening guy yelling, and it felt like he was abusing her. Once I figured that out, all I did was have Helen stretch when she holds her ground and says, "This is not about you." I didn't change any of the dialogue. I just changed the drawings to make her body bigger as if to say, "I'm a match for you." And when I played the revised scene, the brain trust said, "That's much better. What lines did you change?" I said, I didn't change a comma. That's an example of the group knowing something was wrong but not having the solution. I had to go deep and ask, if the dialogue is not wrong, what is? And then I saw it. Oh, that! In the very early days of Pixar, John, Andrew, Pete, Lee, and Joe made a promise to one another. No matter what happened, they would always tell each other the truth. They did this because they recognized how important and rare candid feedback is and how without it our films would suffer. Then and now, the term we use to describe this kind of constructive criticism is good notes. A good note says what is wrong, what is missing, what isn't clear, what makes no sense. A good note is offered at a timely moment, not too late to fix the problem. A good note doesn't make demands. It doesn't even have to include a proposed fix. But if it does, that fix is offered only to illustrate a potential solution, not to prescribe an answer. Most of all, though, a good note is specific. "I'm writhing with boredom" is not a good note. As Andrew Stanton says, there's a difference between criticism